Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of July 22nd, 2011. Hot enough for you out there? Could be a problem if you're having a dinner party this weekend. Here's one solution.
Air conditioning is expensive. Public buildings have to have air conditioning. So you just have people rendezvous, kind of like a flash mob.
Cool and cheap party tips from the Dinner Party Download. Plus, here in Los Angeles, Carmageddon came and went. Fear of gridlock kept drivers off the freeway. Wonder if that could work for other things.
Let's scare everybody into saving or make more visceral that fear that comes with under-saving for retirement. Save now or face Armageddon later.
And the jury is still out on whether money can buy happiness, but here's what you can get with some cold hard cash.
Hair, plasma, eggs, sperm, breast milk, and your body for medical experiments.
Weird but legit ways to make money with what nature and mom and dad gave you. Yeah, we're going to go there on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
How about we start with a weather forecast?
Weather today, hot. Tonight, hot. Tomorrow, hot. Hey, guess what? Big surprise tomorrow night, hot.
That's what I hear, and hot equals expensive, especially if you're having a dinner party this weekend. I mean, all that air conditioning and ice, which is why we have our friends from the Dinner Party Download with us today, Brendan Francis Newnham.
Hey, Tess.
Enrico Galliano.
Hi, Tess. Expertly done. Great segue.
Thank you so much. Gentlemen, I do have to ask, what qualifies you to broach the subject of hotness?
Well, we both hail from Pennsylvania, which this time of year is not exactly known for coolness, let's say.
Indeed.
Yeah.
My parents called me up today, and it sounded like they were swimming underwater, and they were just standing outside. It was very humid out there.
Well, maybe that's the solution. Just have your dinner party underwater.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
You know, one of my dinner party tips when it's hot is actually to go have your dinner party in a public building. So like the library, the lobby of a courthouse.
Because police station?
Yeah, air conditioning is expensive. Public buildings have to have air conditioning. So you just have people rendezvous, kind of like a flash mob, at the public library.
That might be a short-lived picnic, though. What if the security cops come?
I think you can
they'll,
buy
they'll
them
already
off.
Be there if you're in the police station.
That's
yeah,
true.
That's right.
Mine is a little more complex and less elegant, perhaps. What you do is you have people over, and instead of running the air conditioning, you build what is called a bubble house. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Something I used to do as a kid. For a large number of people, you want to get the biggest sheet that you can find. You tie one corner of it to a fan. And then you weigh down the edges with books and then turn the fan on, and it makes kind of like a cooled igloo. And you serve maybe some iced beverages.
I didn't know you were raised in 1950s Brooklyn.
My dad was brought up in 40s Brooklyn. That maybe it filtered down. And also, don't go for – a lot of people will say, oh, I'll just make some gazpacho or something. And nobody is satisfied by gazpacho in my experience.
No, you're hungry like half hour later.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which leads to another kind of cold dinner party suggestion is ceviche is actually a fantastic warm weather dish. Rico and I had lunch earlier this week at a Peruvian restaurant where we had ceviche. But here's the cool part. It was served in an ice bowl.
That solves the problem that
there
I was worried about.
Exactly.
Because you take it out of the refrigerator, and in this weather back east,
instantaneously,
it can go bad.
It's going to go bad within 2 minutes.
And so you can eat the ceviche in this ice bowl, and whatever's still remaining, you can put a little gin and lime in there, and you got a cocktail.
Well, as long as you got enough gin in there, it's not going to matter how hot it is.
That's
right.
That's right. Or frankly, what you had in it before, you'll forget immediately, and you'll think it was awesome.
All right, guys, stay cool.
You too, Tess. Thanks for inviting us.
Always, thanks.
It is my pleasure. And actually, you know, before you go, we usually do this at the end of the show, but you've done such a great job.
You're going to buy us a Roth IRA?
I've been waiting.
I'm going to do you one better. Hang on a second.
Oh, my goodness. What's going on?
Well,
are this week's winners of the Marketplace Money Piggy Bank.
Oh, what? Yes, this is fantastic. Thank you. Can we make bacon out of it?
Plastic bacon.
Only if you serve it at your dinner party.
All right, we promise.
Thanks,
definitely.
Guys.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Tess. And if you want to win your dinner party, do not miss their podcast, The Dinner Party Download. We've got a link at marketplace.org. All right, so there's some advice to follow as you move slowly through the humid haze this weekend. Nothing terribly complex. But what if we were giving you advice you just really didn't want to hear?
Here is what I want you to do. I want you to sell the house. You don't need, forget about it. You don't need, you listen to me. You can't afford the house. The house is too much. You're in San Francisco. I want you to sell the house.
You listen to me, or listen to her. That is Susie Orman, of course, taking one of her viewers to task for retiring way too early. We brought you the first part of our conversation with Orman a few weeks ago. Today, a little more from behind the scenes. She says the begging for permission to do dumb things with money doesn't stop when the cameras stop rolling.
A lot of them will say, no, 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 you didn't have this right. No, I can do this. Let's do this again.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. If you have credit card debt, if you don't have an 8-month emergency fund, if you're not funding your retirement account to the max, if you're not doing what you should be doing, then I am not going to allow you, at least on my watch, to buy something that is a want, not a need.
Well, you know, you will often say to people, hey, look at what you just said to me. There's your answer. I wonder how much of what you tell your audience do you think they actually kind of already know, but they just want to have it affirmed by you?
I think some of them obviously have a feeling, but a lot of them, honest to God, they do not. Just the other day, I did a thing of somebody who wanted to know if she could afford to retire. She was 60 years of age, saved $782,000, and that's everything she had, and I told her no. She, right now, has written 2 or 3 long emails saying, I am wrong. She absolutely can afford to retire. She cannot believe it. She's totally embarrassed, but she thinks because she has $800,000, she can afford it. At the age of 60, she can't start Social Security yet. $700,000, $800,000 today in a retirement account will only generate for you, if you are lucky, about $30,000 a year of income before taxes. After taxes, you're looking at $20,000 a year. Who can live on $1,800 a month?
But boy, you look at those numbers and then you think about some of the average 401k balances that are out there. I mean, you know, there are studies that the vast majority of people who are in their 50s and 60s don't have more than $100,000 stashed away.
That's right. And that's why they're going to have to work for a long, long time. So it's not only how much money you have, but it's how much is the interest rate that you can get on that money going to generate an income for you. Mm-hmm. It's what will the tax brackets be. It's what are your expenses. All of that has to be taken into consideration.
You know, I've seen criticisms of you for being too basic, that the things that you advise people on are just so common sense. Why do you think so many Americans need those basics?
We have to get so basic because you can't put together sentences unless you know the alphabet. When it comes to money, they don't know what a Roth IRA really is. They don't know the difference between a bond and a bond fund. They don't understand APR on their credit cards and what is a FICO score and why do these things matter.
And I guess, again, that this is a problem with both education and a lack of talking within the family about money.
Yes. And, you know, we don't talk about it. We'll talk about sex. We'll talk about all these things before we'll talk about how much credit card debt we have.
You have a longstanding relationship with Fair Isaac.
Yes.
I am fond of asking who died and made FICO king. Do you think their rules are fair?
No. I think the truth of the matter is, if it were up to me, all FICO scores would be absolutely free. I also believe that the FICO scores, that the way that they happen to be calculated, are not a good indicator of what people will and will not do with their money. I think it's an absolute travesty that Experian, which is one of the credit bureaus, will not allow you to buy your FICO Experian score anymore. The only thing that they will sell an individual is this Vantage score, and only maybe 10% of the creditors out there use them. I also think it's absolutely nuts that we have 3 credit bureaus. I think we should form a whole new one and get rid of all the other 3, but that is beside the point. But I think that people need information about themselves, and I think all of that should be given free to everybody.
Susie Orman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
So Susie Orman herself doesn't think Fair Isaac's credit scores are fair. And there's one more piece of evidence to that this week. The new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau issued a report on credit scores. And quite maddeningly, it turns out the number you think you have isn't necessarily the one businesses are using to decide whether to lend to you. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
There's a popular misconception about credit scores, the idea that each person has one single score. In fact, most of us have multiple credit scores, and the variety can work against us. Raj Date is with the brand new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He helped put together last week's congressional report on credit scores.
What the study finds is that, in general, the scores that consumers receive when they buy or otherwise receive a score are typically not the scores that lenders actually use in their decisioning processes.
Here's an example. Alexander Colon is a retiree in Mohegan Lake, New York. He's been diligent about reviewing his credit reports from all three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. He believed his score was excellent.
It's like 95% perfect. I have one late fee, one time.
But when he refinanced his mortgage, his bank assigned him a surprisingly low credit score. He ended up with a more expensive loan than he'd expected.
My monthly rate was $200-$300 more than I wanted to pay.
There are a number of reasons for the inconsistency in credit scores. Small banks often don't share their data with all three credit bureaus, or they don't share data at the same time. Or, most important, different companies use different credit algorithms. As a result, one person can have multiple credit scores. They can vary from one industry to the next. In fact, there's even variation in credit scores that originate from a single company. Take the industry standard, the Fair Isaac Corporation's FICO score. Norma Garcia is an attorney with Consumers Union. She says buying your score from FICO doesn't necessarily mean it will match the score used by lenders.
There are variations in what lenders can do with respect to information they receive from FICO. So they might actually apply their own proprietary model to analyzing that data that could, again, leave the consumer in the dark.
The credit bureaus have come up with their own system for credit scores called Vantage. And other financial companies sell competing products, too. Again, Raj Date with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Many consumers, when they get their free credit report, also pay for a score at the same time. So there are a lot of different channels by which consumers actually get scores, and it's a surprisingly big business today. It's roughly $1 billion in revenues a year.
Is that money well spent? Norma Garcia with Consumers Union isn't so sure.
If this information isn't really being considered by those making decisions about whether a consumer gets a loan, then what value is it? And who's really making the money here? Who's really benefiting? Is it the consumer or is it the credit reporting bureau?
There is some good news. Last week, new rules went into effect making credit reports more transparent. If you apply for a credit card or a car loan and you get denied or you get offered less than favorable rates, the lender is required to share the credit score on which the decision was based. Finally, the consumer will see the exact credit score used by the lender. Too bad it's after the fact. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. The Dodd-Frank financial reform law turned 1 year old this week. The original idea behind the bill was to help avoid another economic crisis. In that effort, Congress created more than 350 rules to monitor the financial system. So, where do things stand a year later? Here's a report card from commentator Richard Barrington.
The Dodd-Frank Act is more than 800 pages long. That's not the type of legislation that cleanly addresses a specific problem. So how have consumers fared since the law went into effect? The answer is a mix of good and bad. Let's start with what should worry consumers. One of the worst parts of the Dodd-Frank law is something called the Durbin Amendment. This comes into play every time you swipe your debit card at a store. The Durbin Amendment directs the Federal Reserve to cap interchange fees. That's a fancy way of saying banks can't collect as much money from retailers for processing debit card transactions. So that's a plus for retailers, but not so much for consumers. After all, no one is naive enough to expect retailers to pass those hidden savings along to their customers. What you can expect is that banks will make up for those lost revenues in the form of other fees. Now the good. There were some clear wins for consumers in the bill. For example, the law made the $250,000 limit on deposit insurance permanent. This limit used to be only $100,000. So more of your money can be protected by the government. But perhaps the most important aspects of Dodd-Frank are rules on how much banks can speculate with your deposits. The days of banks putting your money at risk for their profits should be over. There are stricter rules now on how they use your deposits. That should be a big win for consumers. But since Dodd-Frank became law, the effort to water it down has been relentless. Millions have been spent to lobby against its implementation. So the real question is, can our politicians and regulators resolve to keep the consumer protections in place? Consumers won't win if special interests erode the best features of this law.
Richard Barrington writes about personal finance at moneyrates.com. Give us your thoughts on financial reform on our Facebook page or at marketplace.org/money. Those are also two places where, of course, you can leave your financial questions for us, and it's time to take some of those. Helping us out this week is our good friend David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hello there.
Hiya, Tess.
We're going to have some fun times here. I have a great topic for you, the debt ceiling.
Woohoo! Party!
I knew you'd love it. You know, this story is not going away. A lot of people are writing to us with some pretty serious concerns that we're going to bust this thing, that there is not going to be a deal. And they want to know what to do about it. I just have every hope that this is not going to happen. I think there is no way that they're going to let the government bust this debt ceiling. But if they did, what would happen?
Well, dogs and cats marrying, you know, Armageddon, locusts, you know, no. Let's backtrack just a step. It's important to remember that when we talk about this debt ceiling, what we're talking about is the national credit card.
Right.
And what we're talking about isn't our ability to borrow going forward. It's paying our bills for things we've already bought.
Mm-hmm.
When we see our friends in the Republican Party saying, no, we are not going to raise that debt ceiling, well, it's a little bit disingenuous because they're refusing essentially to extend the credit limit even after running up the credit card. And that's not quite the way you manage your finances. Now, that's not to minimize the importance of what they're saying, because it is an important message. We do need to get our fingers around our spending problems.
Right.
But there is sort of an apples and oranges aspect to this. On the one hand, you have the debt ceiling, which is required to accommodate spending we've already done. Then, on the other hand, you have all this talk about reducing the deficit, reducing our $14 trillion national debt. Also, very important, but it's different. And you don't want to conflate these two issues because suddenly you will make this thing more complicated than you have to. And to put it back into terms that households can understand, on the one hand, there is your credit card bill,
right,
which you need to deal with. On the other hand, there is your monthly budget, which you also need to deal with. But if you put them together too quickly, you'll find that you can't get your finances in order.
Well, then what happens if that credit card blows up?
All right. Well, in the case of this debt ceiling, if we did default, what you would expect instantly, again, looking at it in credit card terms, is if you miss your credit card payments,
interest rates going to skyrocket.
Interest rates go up. And the reason for that is you are now a much greater risk to lenders. And as a result of that, you will almost inevitably look at taxes going up. As taxes go up to pay the higher interest rates, you find that businesses now are higher taxed. They also have less access to credit because of the higher interest rates. They, in turn, are not hiring people, means more people going without jobs, which means less consumer spending, which means our economy tanks. And all those people who say that we are looking at the end of life as we know it, well, it's an exaggeration, but not so much.
All right, David. Well, let's stop talking about the nation's credit card and get to our audience's credit cards, perhaps.
It's about time.
All right. Well, Leo is with us from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Leo.
Hey, how are you?
We're well. You are in one of my favorite places in the world.
Yeah, as long as you have a snorkel.
It's not that bad.
I have been to Seattle maybe a half dozen times, and I swear it rained every single time.
Usually nice during the summertime, but for some reason, it's a little overcast. I don't know why.
Because it's going to rain, dude. That's why.
But hey, come on now. It's like 100,000 degrees on the East Coast today.
Oh, I know. I would much rather be in Seattle than in the middle of the country right now.
I hear that. Yeah.
Well, what can we help you out with today?
My question stems from a YouTube channel that three of us created when I was out living in New York City last year.
Ah, cat videos?
Cat videos, no. That'd be more of my girlfriend's expertise. Our specialty in particular is breakdance videos.
And Let's roll that back.
Is it 1983?
Whoa, settle down now. It's never 1983 with breakdance. It's been around. It's just that the media hasn't had the opportunity to exploit it lately.
Oh, we haven't had the opportunity.
I know, because just last night I was watching Breakdance 2 Electric
Boogaloo.
Oh, I gotta do my moves now. Here I go.
Oh, David, here I go. David is head spinning.
Exactly. Hey, I'm gonna lay down this refrigerator box and there I go. Spinning.
Remember, keep your toes pointed.
Yes, and then I end in this pose. There it is. Looking good.
Oh, you're killing me.
Okay. I think I just broke my neck. Okay, let me get back in the... Ow. Okay.
So, somebody call 911.
I'm all right. Ow.
All right. We've had enough fun here. What is it with the breakdancing? Why are you calling us? Trust me, David cannot help you with that.
We're at it.
Oh.
Okay, well, thanks, guys. Have a great day.
All right, thank you very much.
In particular, we have started it, and we're to the point now where we want to be able to take it to the next level. In particular, be able to, one, join the partnership program.
The YouTube partnership program?
Correct.
And for everybody playing along at home, for every few clicks that somebody gets, if they're a part of the program, they get like a penny or something.
Yeah. Correct. We're to the point now where we want to be able to take advantage of that. Now, there are a lot of moving parts behind the scenes that we need to take out. For example, the business plan, written agreements, stuff like that.
You're asking how to start a small business on YouTube?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, that's where he's going with this. How do you make a little money from your passion?
My biggest concern is in any video you see with breakdancing, there's music playing in the background. And the big concern there is that copyright issues become something of playing, you know? So we want to make sure that we don't infringe on it. But based on what I've heard and what I've read, and there are ways to get around it.
Hmm. Well, you're going to run into fair use issues, first of all. And that fair use means you can use snippets of stuff.
Right.
For free, and you'll be cool with that. But you're correct, Leo, that if you take, Herbie Hancock's Rocket, for instance, shows you how old school I am. Thank you very much. Whoa, here I go again. I'm spinning.
I'd only believe you if you had James Brown playing in the background, and I don't.
But if you took the whole thing, then I'm thinking whoever holds the copyright for that's going to say, dude, have to pony up. So you're going to run into some issues there. But, it really seems to me that your big issue here is one of supply and demand, and that is, what kind of hits do you get?
Right now we're still small. We actually got to about 1,300 subscribers.
You know what I think, Leo? I think as a business, honestly, forget about it. But as a hobby, cool. More power to you. And don't quit your day job, but make this thing happen and, give voice to the community and do all that. But I got to say that I just don't see how you're ever going to make any money from this necessarily.
Right.
Right. This is going to be a labor of love, and there's nothing wrong with that. Some even break through and turn their labor of love into a little bit of a livelihood.
Right.
And I wish you all luck with that.
Right. And I mean, I've considered that as well. So it's not like I've literally stopped everything. I still work a full time, so.
Did we rain on your parade?
A little, but that's okay. That's okay. I do understand.
You're used to rain, right?
There you go. Way to tie it all back
Circling it right back.
Oh, and actually, you know what? If you want to hang on a second, I'm just looking here, and our next caller actually may have some information on copyright if you want to hang on.
Yeah, let's listen in.
All right. Well, Peg is with us, also from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Peg.
Hi, how are you?
And you, from what I see here, teach media, is that correct?
I do.
So give us a little insight.
Well, the best insight is that it is a very gray and muddy area these days, but the good news is that YouTube itself has actually really good information. There's a nice little video there by a guy named Tom Sarkansky on fair use. There is also, and I highly recommend to anybody who's interested in this issue, a documentary called RIP, Remix Manifesto.
Hmm.
And I show it to my students every semester to really get across how gray this is.
So Peg, let me give you a full example. Let's say that I want to make a breakdance video and I want to take all of Vanilla Ice's Ice Baby and dance the whole thing away. Could I use his entire song if I wanted to?
Unlikely. my guess is that somebody from Vanilla Ice might call YouTube and say cease and desist, in which case YouTube would yank it.
Yep.
And you got to have to land where you feel that it's fair to musicians. I mean, that's what copyright's for, right? Is
right.
To be fair to the creator.
Even Vanilla Ice.
Even Vanilla Ice.
All right, there you go, Leo.
All right, well, thanks again, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you, Peg.
Sure.
All right, thanks a lot. Take care.
Thanks.
All right, so Peg, tell us more about yourself. You teach media?
I teach media. I teach at a small college in the Seattle area. I went back to work on a PhD. Love teaching, but I took about a $30,000 pay cut to do that.
So is it actually a second career? Is it completely different from
what
you were doing
before?
Yeah, pretty
much. I worked in the television news business for years, and then I worked in software training in newsrooms, and so I traveled all over. And when I went back to school, I became a contractor for the company who used to employ me full-time.
Uh-huh.
So as friends of mine say, I work in the summer now as a contractor to support my professor habit.
Right.
But I usually gross somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 to $30,000.
Can you support yourself off of your academic career alone?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. I'm pretty diligent about living on what I make in my academic career.
So what you're saying is all the money from your consulting during summer vacation is essentially gravy.
Well, yes, and I'm just trying not to see it that way because I want to be smart with it.
Okay, no, gravy is good.
You can still put gravy in the retirement fund.
Gravy is good. It's a great place to be, and I wish more people could be there.
Yeah.
But really what you need to be thinking about here is, okay, what do I need for my day-to-day life? Because you've got more than one source of income, and a lot of people do at this point. You're in a fortunate position because if the academic revenue can cover you, then you can start looking at the extra money from your consulting primarily as your retirement fund. And now your issue becomes, where am I going to put it, and how can I make it work for me?
Exactly.
So, David, it sounds to me like perhaps we're looking at a separate Roth IRA, maybe?
A Roth IRA, a SEP IRA, possibly, too, is an example that she can go with.
Self-employed.
And what you want to look at here is, just talk to a brokerage or anyone else who's offering these products.
I have a Roth, so I mean, I can contribute more into that Roth.
Also, can you contribute into, do you have a 401k at the university?
They do, but they don't match it.
Oh,
and,
the match is secondary. My question, though, is whether you can take an outside source of income and supplement
and
anything that might be going into, whether it's a 401k or some other retirement vehicle.
Right.
And that way you're going to put all of the money into a single place. It's easier for you to track it, first of all, and then you benefit more from compounding because you're putting more money into a single place.
But
you want to do some due diligence here. You want to talk to the HR department at the school and just kind of get your hands around it and not think of it as funny money or play money, but part of your retirement.
All right, Peg, does that help you out?
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right, and finally we have Leanna from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Leanna.
Hello.
How are you today?
Just fine. How are y'all?
Very well. Oh, I love that.
She said y'all.
She said y'all.
I know. That's great.
Well, what do you do there in Hotlanta?
I am a visual artist, and I'm also a circus aerialist.
What do you do?
Well, I specialize in aerial silks and trapeze.
So you actually hang up there on the trapeze?
Yes.
Oh,
well, a little
my
more
God.
Than hang. I try to do tricks.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
I can interject right here and say, for a column once, I went to a trapeze school.
You did?
And tried it, and it's terrifying.
David, you're such a Renaissance man. I mean, breakdancing,
well,
trapeze.
Yeah. I'm the George Plimpton of radio. I'm telling you, it's amazing.
So do you travel around?
I usually do things around the Southeast. I started this company where we put on circus productions for like corporate events and fancy fundraisers.
What is the single most spectacular thing you can do?
Big drops on the aerial silks. You know, where you climb up and you wrap yourself up and then you fall and fall.
Oh, and you're spinning while you do that.
Sometimes, yeah.
So is this a lucrative effort on your part?
I'm hoping that it will be. It's kind of unpredictable, but for the past few years I've been saving and saving, and I managed to actually have 6 months' income set aside.
Good for you.
Yeah, that's great. Leanne, what do you do with your money now?
Just a plain old savings account.
Now, here's the next question. How do you feel about risk?
I'm sort of terrified that, I don't know, I'm just afraid the second I decide to take any risk, I mean, I wouldn't even know what the options are as far as taking risks. But,
well, first of all, why do you feel the need to take risk? Is this something where you're looking at your six-month cushion and you want to be making more than probably the 1% you're getting in a savings account?
Well, I have the 6 months, and I want to kind of keep that there and pretend like it doesn't exist.
Good.
My question is more concerning, what do I do with what I make on top of that?
Right, how old are you?
I'm 30.
You're 30 years old?
Yeah.
And do you have a retirement plan?
No.
I love the fact, too, that this is somebody who literally risks breaking her neck on the job every day, and yet she's risk-averse out there in the financial world, which is, you know, not a bad place to be either, Leanne. You've got a good attitude here.
Yep.
Here's what I'm going to advise, and that is baby steps. Your next step is a money market account. And I would recommend to starting to dabble a little bit, not with that six-month cushion, but with that extra amount. Don't put it all into a new investment vehicle, but take a little bit, because what you need to start doing, as you did when you started tumbling, for example, first you do a cartwheel, then you do a round off, then you start doing the other moves. Well,
I can relate to that. Okay.
Exactly. So it's the same thing. Take a little bit and maybe put it into an S&P 500 index fund, for example.
Perfect.
A what?
It's called an index fund, which it tracks the broader stock market, and the Standard & Poor's 500 is basically the 500 largest stocks that are out there. It's a good cross-section of the stock market.
You're investing in American business.
What is a little bit, though?
Well, but see, that's up to you. Maybe
$1,000. Oh, okay. I thought you had to have, like, a lot of money to
No.
Some funds will demand a larger buy-in because they're going to offer a slightly better return. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to go for those funds.
Okay.
Does that help you out? Does that help you get started?
I think so. Thank you all for your advice.
Thanks for the call, Leanne.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at our website. It is marketplace.org. Oh, no. Oh,
there
no.
No.
Woo-hoo!
Stop. Spinning.
David, the breakdancer, thanks for being here.
Yeah, represent.
Do remember to check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Last weekend was supposed to be one of the worst weekends ever here in the City of Angels. One you would someday tell your kids and grandkids about. It was going to be chaos, panic, gridlock like we have never seen.
Carmageddon, but it was anything but apocalyptic.
Absolutely, guys. It's very quiet on the road.
65% fewer cars on the road.
Traffic around L.A. was a breeze.
And yes, indeed, it is wide open.
It has been a really smooth go of it.
Carmageddon is, I was trying to think of some good, like, word, like, you know, lame-ageddon.
Yep, lame-ageddon. They closed the busiest freeway in the country, and we all stayed home and took a nap. Which got us wondering here that if we can respond to warnings about saving ourselves from untold hours in traffic, why don't we do the same for warnings about saving for retirement? Suzanne Hsu is here to discuss this with us. She is a marketing professor down the street at UCLA, and I think you happen to live close to the 405, don't you?
I do. I live very close to the university, and the 405 is almost in my backyard. So once they had it shut down at about midnight on Friday, it got very quiet, and we really enjoyed it.
So, you know, what we're talking about here is the fact that warnings for something worked. Why did they work in this instance, do you think?
A few reasons. One was it was a very specific time period, 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that when I teach marketing to my students at UCLA, we talk about using fear in advertising. And it's a tricky thing to use because it can go both ways. Sometimes you scare people so much that they just block it out altogether.
I don't want to hear it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So fear in advertising only works when it's not too scary and it's very clear what you have to do to avoid those bad outcomes. And with Carmageddon, we knew it was easy. You stay home on your couch with a bowl of popcorn and watch a movie and you avoid the whole thing.
Well, basically, you know, we saw what happened over the weekend. We came in on Monday and said, there have to be some lessons here that take us from Carmageddon to what we started calling Save-ageddon around here, where, you know, the message got through, and the message is not getting through to the American people about saving for retirement. What can we learn?
There's a bunch of things that I think we can learn here. Now, on the face, there are a lot of differences between Carmageddon and saving for retirement. At the same time, you're absolutely right. People reacted to the message and did the right behavior.
But when something is so far off, I guess that's where the problem comes in, because you just... you can't imagine what it's going to be like if you don't save.
Absolutely. That lack of ability to really imagine. And you know, go back to Carmageddon. We sit in traffic here in L.A. on a pretty frequent basis.
And for very, very long periods of time.
Exactly. And you sit there fuming the whole time. And it's very salient how painful that is.
Visceral.
And, yeah, exactly. Retirement isn't like that. You can't put yourself forward by those 20 years to think about what it's going to be like. There's some research that's starting to try to get at that problem. Hal Erstner Hirschfeld, who's at NYU, and some of his colleagues, they've used a computer program that takes a picture of your face, ages it by 30 or 40 years.
Oh, no.
Which, of course, people don't really like to see. And then they make that old face of you smile or frown, depending on how much you're saving. And all of a sudden... people want to save.
I actually like the observation of writer Russ Baker. He said in a recent column that threatening us with the imminent end of civilization as we know it is the only way to get us to behave rationally for our own good. Is that the case?
That's a great observation. I hadn't heard that one. But I think even there, you know, again, it comes back to what can I do about it? If the end of civilization is something that's way outside of my hands and my perception, I'm just going to go home and hide under the covers.
Right. I'm going to have an extra bowl of ice cream.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I was trying to think about what can we learn from Carmageddon to apply to Save Again.
There have to be some lessons here that could be used.
Absolutely. So the short time frame, I think, is a key one. Mm. And if I could... take one thing we learned from Carmageddon, apply it to retirement savings. I could imagine a 401k provider, some sorts of retirement savings provider that would give you a website that says, okay, in the year, you know, 2040, there's a chance you might not make your rent. And, you know, that's something I can deal with. I can put aside an extra $1,000 today if it's going to pay my rent in July of 2040. But it needs to be that very clear, I need to take a specific action today to get a specific result on a specific future date.
I wonder how much of this is also the messaging. I mean, you know, Carmageddon, carpocalypse. I wonder if there is some word or phrase that we could all come up with that would really kind of get across this notion that it's not going to be pretty if you don't start doing this.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the word we have right now is retirement. What do you think of when you think of retirement, Tess?
Lazing on the beach, traveling. It really is not very actionable.
No.
Right?
Exactly. It sounds fun.
Well, you know, I'm so interested in finding a Carmageddon type phrase that while we've been talking, I've actually gone on Twitter and asked my followers if they have any ideas. And there are a couple of really fun ones that have come in. Caroline Delbert writes, Armageddon older.
Oh, I love
it. Not too bad. Not too bad. And AARP-ageddon. And Marie Halverson Gainapola says the 401k horsemen of the apocalypse.
I like that one,
yep,
too.
That works, too.
That was very good. Yeah.
So let's get listeners to be writing in this weekend and telling us some of their suggestions as well. Suzanne Chu, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Tess.
So do please see if you can come up with anything better than my Twitter followers. I'm kind of loving ARPageddon. And here's another bit of homework. Next week, we are turning to finance and economic poetry. Limericks, to be specific, like this one about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
As lenders may oft have no scruple to set rates that may even quadruple, federal usury laws are needed because they'll look for a state with a loophole.
That is Dr. Goose, limericker extraordinaire. We'll have him on the show next week, and we'll tell you who he is. Meantime, we want your limericks about the debt ceiling. Tweet them to me at Radio Tess or post them on our Facebook page. All the maneuvering in Washington over the debt ceiling appears to have killed the idea of a grand bargain. legislation that could include reform of entitlements like Social Security and Medicare. Social Security's reserves will dry up in 2036 if nothing is done to fix the problem. It won't be able to pay out more than it takes in payroll taxes. That's pretty much bad news for everybody, from people close to retirement all the way down to toddlers. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer decided to take a look at the issue through the prism of her own family.
On a holiday, no one wants to talk about Social Security, but I did just that over the July 4th weekend, wrenching my family away from talk of baseball and kids. There were a few wisecracks from my nephew Ben when I asked if he and his friends ever discussed retirement.
Honestly, though, we usually sit around and watch a football game, and at commercials we talk about Social Security.
Smart Alec. But eventually I did get a sense of how each generation of my family has been or will be affected by Social Security. First, my grandmother. She was born in 1907. She was already an adult when Social Security was created. She didn't start paying the payroll tax that funds Social Security until she was in her 30s, yet she got a steady check in retirement. My parents paid more into the system. They're getting that money back and then some. But my generation won't be so lucky.
Well, I hope there's some there, but I'm not planning on it being the backbone of my retirement.
That's my sister Beth. Our brother Bill has read a lot about what'll happen to him after the Social Security Trust Fund runs out, about a decade into his planned retirement. He thinks he'll still be getting something from Social Security when he stops working.
Well, I'm 53. And that would be 10 years to 15 years from now. I'm doing my best to save now so that we don't have to count on Social Security. I think it'll be around, but I don't think the percentage is going to be there that's supposedly there now.
My brother and I used to fight a lot, so I hate it when he's right. If nothing is done to shore up the retirement system, his benefits will be cut by a quarter once the trust fund runs dry in 2036. The next generation will be hit even harder. My brother looks around at his kids, nephews, and nieces as he muses about their role in this Social Security saga.
And I think for those that might be in their 20s, I would expect that it will continue to be a tax, but I wouldn't plan on any sort of benefit, because you're going to have to support us old people.
How frustrating. He's right again. If nothing is done before 2036 and Congress doesn't want to slash benefits, it'll have to raise Social Security payroll taxes by a third instead. My nephew Ben is 23. He sums up the feelings of many 20 and 30-somethings about contributing more to a retirement system they think is on shaky ground.
I don't feel that Social Security benefits will be around to take advantage of when I'm retirement age.
Ben's 18-year-old sister Leah learned about her status in the Social Security pecking order in high school from a retiring American history teacher.
My teacher was a baby boomer, and she was, like, thanking us all for paying for her retirement. And it was a little depressing. It was a little shocking.
The news gets grimmer the younger you are. My poor little kids are really in trouble. I have 2-year-old twin boys. In 2085, they'll be 76. If nothing changes, Social Security won't even be able to pony up 3/4 of promised payments. Benefits will have to be slashed again. My kids sum up their situation better than I can.
Uh-oh.
It doesn't have to be this way. Ronald Lee has made a career of studying families like mine. He's a demographer and economist at Berkeley. Lee says we can make some gradual changes to Social Security now to replenish the trust fund.
It's definitely true that if we act today, raising taxes and cutting benefits, then it's going to be easier on future generations.
Lee says we could raise the retirement age to 69 or 70 and require the wealthiest Americans to pay Social Security taxes on more of their earnings. A bit of tough medicine now to avoid howls of pain in the future. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace Money.
Bye-bye.
And finally this week, we were talking in our story meeting last Monday about the current blood shortage at the American Red Cross, which got one of our reporters thinking about the value of blood, and then the value of all the rest of our body parts and fluids. Marketplace's Adrian Hill joins me now in studio to give personal finance a whole new meaning. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Tess.
So what do you have for me?
Well, the tough economy has people thinking of all sorts of ways to make money, including selling off bits and pieces of themselves.
Oh, no.
I know. Here's a clip from the TV show Modern Family. And just to set this up a little, a young boy comes into the room holding a toy musical organ.
Hey, Dad. I think I found a place online where I can sell this organ. Can you drive me to the black market?
I think they mean a different kind of organ, buddy.
Sweetie, why are you trying to sell that?
In case things with Dad's job get even worse.
Okay, kind of funny, kind of sad.
Yeah.
Anyway, what'd you find? Which of my body parts can I sell? Should I need or want to do that?
Now, legally, are you in the realm of legal here?
Yes, please.
Okay,
please.
We'll start with the least stomach-churning test, your hair.
Yeah.
You could lop it off and sell it.
For any real money?
Well, have you dyed it?
Am I going to announce this publicly? yes, I call it enhanced dishwater blonde.
Your colorist is a genius,
thank
Tess.
Thank you.
But no good for selling your hair. The market for human hair is best for hair that is uncolored and unpermed, long, untreated locks, sort of flowy, shiny, can fetch hundreds of dollars,
really?
Actually. A lot of people want hair they don't have. Actually, here's a clip from a Chris Rock documentary called Good Hair about African-American hair.
So what's in your hair now?
This is a weave.
This is a weave. Two pieces here. You know, like extensions. Like that.
It turns out India is actually one of the biggest suppliers of hair.
Oh, who knew? All right. So back to what else we can sell of ourselves?
Well, blood is interesting. There isn't a market for paid blood donations in the U.S.
Yeah, why is that?
There's a concern that if people get paid for giving blood, they might attract a population of donors, including addicts, people who need cash right away that you don't really want blood from.
Yeah.
So right now, even though blood is valuable and even though a hospital will charge you a lot for blood if you need it, it's not worth anything to the donor other than a cookie or so.
Yum.
But you can sell plasma for 40 or 50 bucks a week, or you could be a living guinea pig, test. It's your big chance and participate in medical tests.
Oh, that sounds really pleasant.
Yeah, you can let doctors stick you and poke you and watch you sleep. Again, it's probably not a way to get wealthy.
No, and not a way to get healthy either, it sounds like. All right, so where's the big money?
Eggs, Tess. It's all about the eggs.
Yep.
Couples looking to get pregnant will pay a whole lot of money for eggs from the right donor. We're talking $5,000 or even $10,000. But to fetch that big money, you've got to be smart, healthy, and young.
I have 2 out of 3 of those.
Does I'm no fertility clinic, but I guess we're both probably not the spring chickens the clinics are looking for.
No, no. The babies would come out with, you know, like backaches and walking sticks.
While we're talking reproduction, we might as well talk about sperm.
Sperm it is. All right. How much money for that?
Here in California, a single sperm donation will fetch around $60 to $100. And the nice thing is you can give over and over if you're a guy, at least as the sperm bank wants your sperm. They're looking for donors who match that smart, healthy, and young profile.
Yes. All right. So anything else people can sell of themselves to make money?
Yeah. I was surprised by this next one. Human breast milk.
Really?
Yeah. There are websites online where women sell milk for $1 or $2 an ounce.
And that's still in the range of legal?
In most states, it is. Hmm. There aren't federal laws against it. The FDA doesn't regulate it, but they definitely advise against it. So does Pauline Sakamoto, who runs a milk bank where they take and test donated milk before sending it on to babies that need it. She says the less structured online breast milk market is one to avoid.
Buying human milk online or casual sharing is risky, and the reason why is that you don't know the quality of the milk.
Yeah, you don't know, is it even human milk? I mean,
right.
If somebody just online is like, I'll send you my breast milk, you don't know if they're sending you human milk, if it's clean, if it's safe. So.
All right. So what can you not sell?
Organs. Organs, right. Tests. Federal law makes it illegal to sell organs for money, including kidneys, lungs, bone marrow, eyes, and skin.
No exceptions here. Nothing.
Not in the U.S. You can donate organs, and the recipient can pay expenses, but they can't pay money for the organ itself. The idea is that we don't want to incentivize people in a tight spot to sell away a piece of themselves. There are a lot of people who think these laws should be changed. They argue that paying people for healthy organs could end up saving a lot of lives.
All right. So just to sum this one up, you can sell
hair, plasma, eggs, sperm, breast milk, and your body for medical experiments.
Got it. Thanks, Adrian.
No skin off my back.
Oh, gross. Hey. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, planning on taking the kids to see Grandma this summer or maybe just get away for the weekend? Be sure you stop by the ATM first.
Yeah, I'm actually concerned because we have two cars. So each one, probably it's going to be like $70, $80 just because of the toll.
Ouch! Reworking the summer travel budget to accommodate our broke cities. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Special thanks this week to Patty Hirsch. You can blame him for that body parts story. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.